For the week of August 25th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 202, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
At the Ed Sullivan Theater in New York City, I'm Michael Gill.
Well, you're back from Birmingham, Alabama, but yes, why are you at the Ed Sullivan Theater?
Well, because I see you have prepared a top 10 list for the show, so I feel like I'm on Letterman.
Oh, you're looking at the show notes. Okay.
Yes, I am.
Well, yes, this is, you know, after all, the podcast here that brings you all the news fit to talk about over the past week, all the entertainment news, that is.
We're 2 weeks in this case.
2 weeks in this case.
Because we took a week off. Well, we, I mean you.
Yes, well, thank you for reminding everybody of that. But the question is, what are our excuses for why, or should I say, what were we doing during our two-week hiatus? Top 10 things we were doing, and they all relate here. So one, or I should say 10, we wanted to prepare for the launch of Al Jazeera America and Fox Sports One. Have you watched any of those networks yet?
I don't get them on my channel.
That's true, since we're both Time Warner customers. We were making sure we were completely outfitted for duck hunting season. You know what that reference is?
Oh my God, yes.
Okay,
you can ask me for everyone.
Yes, I am.
Not supposed to talk about the joke after you make it.
Okay. I thought humor was much more poignant or...
Keep going.
Okay. So I don't know whether I said two or eight, nine. Okay, so we're on eight if we're counting backwards. We're on three if we're counting forwards. We were combing through the stacks of records at Whole Foods. Number seven, we had to catch up on watching all of this summer's animated films. Number six, we were busy... Am I on the right one? Number six, we were busy mining Universal Pictures Library for more 20-year-old movies to re-release. Number four, we were...
Five.
Number five, okay. You know what? I should have just read it. And number five, we were reading Nirvana's original record contract with Sub Pop, which was for a mere $600. Couldn't believe that when I read that. And it was one page long, so it didn't take us very long. Where was I? Number four. Number four. We were at Best Buy picking up a free antenna in order to watch Under the Dome in 60 Minutes on CBS. That's a
three.
Time Warner joke. Number three, thank you. Have somebody counting for me. We were polishing our resume so we could apply for an interesting position at Microsoft, which was recently posted on Hot Jobs.
Number two.
Number two, we were hard at work building non-elitist playlists for Beat Music.
Number one.
Number one. We were auditioning for an important role in a highly anticipated blockbuster, but they ultimately gave the part to Ben Affleck.
So in your list of all these excuses why we took a week off, all I can say is we, Kimasabi.
Oh, okay. So that's the old joke. What do you mean, we, white man?
Right. So the least I can say, you were tying into some of the stories we'll be talking about this week. Tell us about what we will be covering on what has turned into a comedy podcast, or at least a would-be comedy podcast.
And the would-be part, I think, is that comment is direct.
Keep going.
Okay. Well, we're going to do a little bit of a summer box office recap. We'll talk a little bit about this summer's box office. We'll also, how could we avoid talking about the much buzzed about casting of Ben Affleck as Batman? We're going to talk about the debut of two new high-profile streaming music services, iTunes Radio and Beats Music.
Actually happening, right?
It is. Both of them are actually happening, yes, in September, it looks like. We'll try to explain why cable package bundles may actually be good for you. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to my straight man, entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I haven't been called that in a while. Ba-dum-bum. So anyway, the number one movie around the world at the box office, I had to rub my eyes. I thought I was seeing things. Jurassic Park 3D. That made $30 million around the world, almost all of it in China. It made about $28 million in China. As you remember, it opened up in the U.S. earlier this year. It made about $45 million when all was said and done. Now it's opened up in China. It's also in 10 other territories. But the bulk of that money, $30 million, was made in China. Which brings us to the fact that, and we've been talking about the story of the standoff between the Hollywood studios and a Chinese production company, which is a front for the government. There's a big standoff about who's going to pay this tax, who's not going to pay it. Is Hollywood going to have to shoulder the burden, or will the Chinese studio be paying it? They finally come to terms. Chris Dodd and the MPAA have finally negotiated a deal. Yes, Hollywood will get all their money. The standoff is over. So now they're showing movies in China. They only get 25%, you know, one-fourth of the total gross. But at least they're actually going to get their money, because it's been a year or 2 years for some movies.
No. It's been a year. It's been since like last...
Oh, but some people say they didn't even get money for Life of Pi, and that's like 2 years. So,
November of last year is when it stopped.
Yes, but Life of Pi, they said they weren't getting that before either.
Yeah, well, that was November of last year.
Well, that's 2011.
No, of 2012.
No, Life of Pi was 2011. No, 2012. I thought it was 2 years.
No, 2011. Right. Yeah, I mean, basically,
it's over. The long national nightmare is over. China has caved. They're not going to force Hollywood to. They're not going to take with one hand and bring back with another.
They're not going to say yes. You can up it from 17% of the take for you all Hollywood studios. You can take 17%. Well, up it to 25%. Except there's an 8% surcharge. Yeah, no, they're not going to do that. And that was the China Film Group that you're referring to in SARFT. And it looks like SARFT, they were going to try and discuss this value-added tax at some cabinet meeting, and they tabled the conversation. They said, you know, let's talk about this like never. How about that?
And so Jurassic Park 3D, Steven Spielberg's movie from all those years ago, they're still working on perhaps a Jurassic Park 4. It made $90 million so far in this reissue as a 3D, repurposed 3D film. China, of course, is crazy about 3D films, even though the bloom is off the rose for much of the rest of the world.
Right, and have you noticed we're going backwards? Like, this was Jurassic Park, right? And earlier, I don't think it was this year, maybe it was last year, that Titanic reopened.
Well, but Titanic had never opened in China.
Right.
So that was why there was such a pent-up demand to see that movie on a big screen. It is the sort of film you do want to see in a theater. And a cheap bootleg just isn't going to do it justice. So, you know, that made sense. If you'd never seen Gone with the Wind when it opened in the 60s or the 70s, it made a lot of money in those countries. So, you know, it's not unusual. Classic films have been re-released in theaters throughout Hollywood's history.
Yeah, but wait a second. Gone with the Wind was like in the 30s, so...
I saw it in the 70s in a movie theater. I saw Sound of Music in the 70s. Classic Hollywood films have been reissued in theaters in U.S. and around the world as long as Hollywood's been around.
Yes, but I guess what I'm saying is we're going backwards. So 97 was Titanic, 94 is Jurassic Park. What do you think the next big re-release in China is going to be? It has to be
China?
Yeah, pre-1994.
I don't know. I don't care. What do you mean? Is there a movie you have in mind?
No. I was just, you know, going backwards through time. Maybe Star Wars. Star Wars, you know, 1970.
I think that was properly released in China.
Okay.
So that is the number one movie around the world. Jurassic Park is sort of a classic franchise. It used to be in the old days. You released a movie. If it was a big hit, you put out a sequel. The sequel made like half of what the original made, or maybe a little bit more if you were lucky. Then if you were lucky, you put out a third film, and that made like a third of what the original made. That's exactly what happened with Jurassic Park. But these days, that's not how franchises work. Now, these days, you get movies that they make seven movies, and they all make the same amount of money. So the rules have really gone out the window with franchises. But Jurassic Park is one of the last examples of a classic Hollywood franchise where the sequels make less and less every time out. But number two around the world is not a franchise, but the second film of a director a lot of people had high hopes for. It's Elysium, the Matt Damon sci-fi film. It made $27 million around the world. It's at $139 million and counting. And number three around the world, a would-be franchise, which has fallen flat on its face, Percy Jackson's Sea of Monsters. I think it's Sea of Monsters, right?
Yes, I believe so.
That grossed another $23 million around the world. It's at $111 million and counting. We'll have to see if Percy Jackson can pull it together and, you know, actually make back $250, $300 million so that $90 million budget doesn't prove to be a bad idea. At number four around the world, one of the big hits of the last few months, We're the Millers, starring Jennifer Aniston as a stripper. It made another $22 million. It's at $115 million and counting. It's starting to open up overseas. It's made a lot of money in the U.S. where it's zeroing in on $100 million. This is a big success story for Jennifer Aniston, who started off slow in Hollywood, making some small movies that got some good notices. And then she started to make a fair number of hits. She never really gets credit for any of them. People don't see her as a box office draw, but she has consistently in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years made some, you know, big size comedies that don't cost a lot but make a lot of money. And We're the Millers is a good example. It costs $37 million to make, and it's going to make $150 million worldwide easily.
Yeah, I guess the Good Girl is what you're referring to. She was in The Good Girl.
Sure.
Yeah, and films that were kind of indie.
That's right. She was trying to, you know, get away from her friend's persona and be taken seriously as an actress. And she proved herself with some talent, but she's always been a woman who seems to have underperformed. You know, she had a lot of appeal on Friends. You thought she could have been a much bigger star, but I think just choosing the right material is the hardest thing. It's one of the really underappreciated skills of creating a career long term. And I don't think she's really had it, though she has had some commercial success. At number five around the world, Monsters University, one of those cursed animated films, which Hollywood Reporter says is just simply, you know, never going to make any money. It made $20 million. It's at $686 million and counting. At number six around the world, The Conjuring, the cheapo horror film, made $20 million. It's at $220 million and counting. That's all gravy, practically, for Warner Brothers. At number seven, another would-be franchise, which, like Percy Jackson, has fallen flat on its face. But this time, right out of the gate, it's Mortal Instruments, City of Bones. It made $17 million around the world. It's at $22 million and counting. It opened very poorly in North America. It opened at number three in North America, where it made about $9 million. I saw a lot of press for this movie. I guess I'm being hard on it, but it seemed clear from the beginning that this was not going to be a big success story. And people were doing all these stories and looking at the movie, and is this the next Twilight? It's like, it didn't even look remotely like it was going to be a success. So I'm a little disappointed that people covered it as if it was going to be a big new movie. I guess I'm being silly, but they treated it. I've seen the author everywhere in the last 2 weeks. I don't know, USA Today, here and there, on TV, on radio, in print, in Publishers Weekly. You know, if you're going to do a story on this series, you got to be a little more realistic and say, well, it doesn't look like it's going to be a massive hit, but who knows what will happen. But the reviews were poor. The buzz was poor. I don't really like the series of books that much.
What series of books is it?
I think it's called, is it called Mortal Instruments or City of Bones? I forget which is the title of the series. I've only read one of them. I was unimpressed. I didn't continue.
Ah, okay.
And there you go. But anyway, I guess I'm asking too much. If you're doing a story on a movie, you're not going to diss the movie that much. You know, if you're going to profile the author of the books, I guess it's asking too much to say that you be realistic and tell people, this doesn't look like a winner. At number eight around the world is Lee Daniels' The Butler. It made another $17 million. It's at $52 million and counting. It, of course, repeated at the box office in North America. It's not open anywhere
else. By repeated, you mean it was the number one movie in the North America this week, as it was last week.
Was there another way to interpret that?
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
All right.
I'm just clarifying.
As I said, it's not playing in any other territory, basically. It's only playing in North America. It may not even open up anywhere else. So they're lucky to be making, you know, $60, $80, $90 million on this movie, which is exactly where they're going to be headed, because it costs $30 million to make, and they need to make back all their money in North America, because frankly, they may not even bother to release it in Europe or overseas, because that's what they do with these movies. I don't know why. I think they should have a worldwide audience. There's a lot of stars in it. But Hollywood has a very myopic vision about films starring black actors.
Well, don't you think it's also a very American story? I mean, it's about the, you know, a butler to the American president.
That doesn't mean it's not going to be of interest. We all watched The Queen starring Helen Mirren. That was a big worldwide hit. It's about the Queen. You've seen only British people want to read it. Good movie is a good movie. Not that this is a good movie, but it's commercially successful. And I think the idea that you shouldn't even bother to release Tyler Perry films or these films overseas is they're leaving money on the table.
Touché.
At number nine around the world is Smurfs 2. They're not done yet, though they're close to it. Another $15 million is at $235 million and counting. At number 10, Planes, the spinoff from Pixar's Cars, which Disney has touted long as, it's going to go straight to DVD, but it was so good we released it in theaters. As Sperling points out, they've been saying that for like a year and a half, two years.
At least, yeah.
And they spent $50 million on the movie. So wait a second. If it was straight to DVD, why the heck are you spending $50 million on it? We decided 2.5 years ago to spend more. So this isn't a straight to DVD movie that they suddenly decided to put in theaters. It's a really cheap theatrical release.
That's right.
And it's made $77 million worldwide and counting. Not doing well, but if it gooses a lot of toy sales, they'll be happy. At number 11, a much more successful animated film, Despicable Me 2. It passed the $800 million mark. This is a monster of a film. It's the highest grossing Universal film of all time, passing Jurassic Park.
Ooh, okay.
Though now with Jurassic Park pulling in more money, that may just be turned back on its head again.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it like, you know, $30 million away?
Yeah, you're right. Before this re-release, it's the second highest grossing Universal film of all time behind Jurassic Park. Because Jurassic Park is at $960+ million. If it makes another $38 million, and it looks like it will or could, then it will hit the $1 billion club, which is rare indeed, especially given how long ago it came out.
Wow.
At number 12, Now You See Me, the very successful film about illusionists who rip off banks. It's made $292 million worldwide. It's just edging towards $300 million. Another big success story worldwide. It made $116 million in the U.S., looks like it will almost double that overseas, which is what it should do. But this is an adult film with older geared towards older audiences. So doing this well around the world is very much a big success story. At number 13, not a success story, Kick-Ass 2. Very poor reviews, very weak box office. Not a big budget, but it made $11 million around the world. It's at $38 million and counting. It only cost, how much was it? $28 million to make. So it probably won't, you know, it won't lose any money, but it's not going to be a success like the original was on a modest level. At number 14, a definite success story is The World's End. This is another film by the British guys behind Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead. They have a strong worldwide following.
Edgar Wright.
That's right.
Yeah. And it
made $9 million. It's at $25 million in counting. It opened nicely in the U.S. It didn't open on a ton of theaters, but it had a good per screen average. It opened at number 4, but it's a success, whereas Mortal Instruments opened at number 3, and it's a failure.
Right.
It all depends on what your budget is, how wide you open, and how well you do. The World's End opened well. It's on 1,500 screens. It grossed over $5,000 per screen. It's already made a good amount of money in the UK. So this looks like this $20 million film will be a success story. And it's the end of their trilogy, their faux trilogy. Number 15, Adam Sandler's Grown Ups 2. That's at $186 million worldwide. At number 16, Hide and Seek, another $8 million. And at number 17, The Wolverine, Hugh Jackman's film. Down at the towards the bottom, you have some movies that are long running. And you ask, why do they keep making so many sequels? Well, it's because they make so much money. The Wolverine is about to close in on the first one. It might just make the same amount as the first Wolverine film. But also is Monsters University, which made more than Monsters, Inc. Despicable Me 2, which made more than Despicable Me. Star Trek Into Darkness, which is still playing in theaters overseas. That's at $458 million. That's the highest grossing Star Trek film, even adjusting for inflation. The Lone Ranger, bad idea, but it's still the highest grossing Lone Ranger film of all time. So that's why they keep making all these movies.
So what you're saying is the highest grossing Lone Ranger movie of all time has taken in $230 million.
That's right.
Right, which means you should spend $250 million just making it.
I didn't say it was a financially wise choice.
Yeah, well.
But now one of the movies we should talk about, whether it was a wise choice to expand it, is Blue Jasmine. That's the Woody Allen film, tearing it up in limited release. And by limited release, I'm talking about 200 screens. Now they've expanded to 1,200 screens. It's the widest release of any Woody Allen film in history. They added over 1,000 screens, and they couldn't even double the box office. It's not a disaster, but it grossed $4.3 million. And it's making about $3,300 per screen. Its total now is $14 million. It's chugging along. It's going to be what amounts for Woody as a big commercial success. But was it a smart idea to expand it by over 1,000 screens? Sperling?
Well, you know, for 1,000 screens, that's still it's not a lot.
It is a lot. You can make a gazillion dollars on 1,000 screens.
You can, but, you know, I went to see, a little slight aside here, I went to see this movie, Blue Jasmine, at a movie theater near me. It's a duplex on a Saturday.
No, when? Like this Saturday or a couple weeks ago? A
couple weeks ago.
Okay, was it full?
It was packed. And it was packed with people
who
may have been about 3 times my age.
Well, that's okay, but that's my point. I think everyone who went to see Blue Jasmine this weekend had a less good time. No matter what the quality of the film is, it's more fun to see a movie in a crowded theater. There's an energy from the crowd, especially in a comedy or even a drama where people are really focused and caught up in a film. You're in a mostly full auditorium. You're going to have a much better experience.
What was the per screen average on this? Do we know what the per screen average was?
$3,352. Last week, it was $10,000. 2 weeks ago, it was $20,000.
Then to answer your question on a month...
There would have been three times as many people if you'd gone to the theater last week as if you did this week.
To answer your question, from a monetary basis, the answer is yes. They should have expanded it to 1,000 screens because they will make $1,000 per print. After they pay for the virtual print fee, which is probably what they have to do for most of them, and after they do the box office, they'll walk out with about $1,000. The distributor, that is.
$1,000? You're confusing people.
Per screen.
Well, who cares about what they made per screen? You mean then that's not the point. The point is how much longer would the movie run? They expanded it too quickly, so everybody who went this weekend had an time because it was a third emptier than it was, 2 weeks ago. There was a half empty theaters when they went to see the movie this weekend, which means they didn't have as good a time, which means word of mouth is not as good, which means the movie may peter out in another 2 weeks.
Playing if devil's advocate,
it, what I am. And if they kept it in theaters and 250 screens, they could have run for maybe another 10 weeks because people were going and they're having a good time.
Well,
the same film, if you've got a 3/4 empty auditorium, you're not going to have as good a time. word of mouth for most people would not be as good.
Well, I mean, I'm sure part of these 1,000 screens means that it's playing in areas that it wouldn't otherwise have played near. So there's that issue. Now, what I found interesting when I went to see it, I saw it at this Tuplex, a Regency in the suburbs of Los Angeles, and they played all these trailers beforehand. And you know how trailers are. They're loud, and they have 5.1 surround sound, and they're, you know, they're in your face. And then all of a sudden, there was no kind of bumper into the film itself. It just went trailer, 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 movie. And it went from 5.1 surround sound to mono in the front of the auditorium.
Mono?
Well, yeah, all of Woody Allen's movies are in mono.
Still?
Still. So it was very, you could really tell. Not only that, this movie theater was actually showing the movie on film. And it was
really, that's very unusual.
Yes, not digital. And I kind of looked at it and went, oh, wow. Yeah, I guess you can tell there is a quality difference between a digital projection and a traditional 35 millimeter projection. And it's kind of like going from DVD back to VHS. You kind of go, oh, yeah, I guess digital.
Oh, you think digital is superior to 35 millimeter
in this particular case, meaning I don't know whether this was an optimized 35 millimeter presentation. And I dare to say it wasn't. The print was scratched and, you know, there was dust everywhere. So in that sense, no.
Isn't there more detail still on a 35 millimeter print?
On a print? No. On a negative? No. Yes.
On a negative. Thank you. So now, how much of a risk was this? I'm saying that they left money on the table because it won't run as long and ultimately they'll make less money. Instead of making $30 million, they'll make $20 million. That's the exaggerated claim I'm making because they expanded it too soon. And that's possible. You expand a movie too soon, you lose the excitement of sold out shows and people wanting to see the movie and a big full crowd.
You see, and the distributor would say, you know what? The marketing campaign was 2 weeks before the movie opened and 2 weeks after the movie opened. And 3, 4, 5, 10 weeks from now, there's not going to be any commercials.
The movies still run long times. Those days are mostly gone, but it's still possible. And it's Woody Allen. You don't have massive marketing campaign. He's not front loaded. It isn't, you know, the Avengers. It's Woody Allen. People will go 8 weeks into the run. But anyway, my question is, how much of a financial risk was it? Used to be if you opened 1,000 new prints, that's a lot of money. It was $1,000 per print. Now with digital, it's like, what, $100 for a print?
No, because you still have virtual print fees. So until the equipment is paid off in the next 5 to 10 years, you still have
to... So it was the same financial risk.
It was the same financial risk, which is why I did that very quick calculation where I said, okay, so financially, they actually, the distributor... You know,
we know they're going to make more money if they open on an extra 1,000 screens. The question is whether we didn't think they would actually literally lose money this weekend. The question is whether long term they lose money. But anyway, have they lost money at the box office in the summer? I think last episode you made an offhand comment what a terrible year it was at the box office, and I almost questioned it, but I didn't. And now here's my chance, because the box office for 2013 is now matching the box office of 2012.
Right. I didn't say that it was awful.
2012.
What I was saying is it seemed like all of these big summer, you know, there were like 17 big blockbusters during the summer. Summer, usually you don't have more than like 5 to 8 films that big blockbusters that can do well in a summer as opposed to 17. So that means at least 9 films were going to be disappointments. And we did have some. We had, you know, The Lone Ranger. And
there's always disappointments, but I think good movies beget good movies. You know, you like to see a good movie, you go back next week and see another one. I don't think there's a limit. You know, you don't want to be too stupid and open 5 Westerns on the same weekend. But I think, you know, the more the merrier. There's people that have a great time at the movies are going to go back next week. Oh, my God, they had another great time. They'll go back the week after that. And the fact is that the summer 2013 is going to set an all-time record, passing the $4.4 billion gross of 2011. Emissions, by the way, are up 7%, so it's not just inflated ticket prices. And what really bothers me was that I think a couple weeks ago, a Hollywood Reporter said, oh, the gap between this year and last year is troubling. It's already been made up. You know,
never look at 1 year, for Pete's sake, people.
Right. Exactly. Don't they listen to Showbiz Sandbox? But what are the big hits of 2013, at least in North America? We're not talking worldwide now. We're talking North America. What have been the big movies of the year?
Iron Man 3 comes in at $407 million just in North America.
And that is a $1.5 billion worldwide. That's massive, massive. Why that movie made $1.5 billion, I have no idea.
Well, you know, think about it. You know, you want to know the importance of foreign grosses? Look at this. $407 million in North America. More than $1 billion overseas. So,
and that's the way it should always be, because there's 7 billion people in the rest of the world.
And there's only 300 million, or let's call it 500 million here in North America, that not counting Mexico. Okay, so Despicable Me 2 came in second so far, $350 million+.
And counting.
And counting, yeah. Man of Steel, I guess, is still going too, at $289 million. And Monsters University after that, so that's one, two, three, fourth. So Monsters University is fourth. It earned, in North America alone, $261 million. And I guess, do you want me to keep going here?
Keep going, because I'm waiting for something. Keep going.
Okay, Fast and Furious 6 came in next with $238 million. I don't know where we are. Oz the Great and Powerful, $234 million. Again, these are all North American grosses. Star Trek Into Darkness, the second in the J.J. Abrams helmed Star Trek series, $227 million in North America. World War Z, $198 million in North
America. There we go.
I knew
finally.
That. I was thinking as I was going down this list after you said you were waiting for something, I thought, what is he waiting for? And the second I saw World War Z, I said, oh, I bet you he's waiting for that. $198 million in North America alone.
And what's notable about World War Z?
That it's the
it's
last
an original film. It's not a franchise.
Okay.
Not a remake or a franchise.
But it's got zombies in it. It may as well be a remake.
It's based on a novel, but it's an actual franchise. It's an actual original film.
What about The Croods? That was an actual original film.
Right,
that's
right below it. But the World War Z was the first example. The first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 movies were all remakes, franchises, reboots, etc.
What about The Heat? That came in next.
Yeah, I know. The last three, the bottom three, were all original.
Okay.
But they're big hits. The Heat's a big hit. The Croods was a solid hit. World War Z was scraped by into a hit. There you go.
Well, you know, you asked about, for Woody Allen, you know, his movies play really well long term and everything. They also play really well, apparently, overseas. Rio de Janeiro, the mayor of Rio de Janeiro, said he will fund an entire Woody Allen project as long as it's shot in Rio.
What? Oh, I just see your quote. He sent him a plane ticket?
Yes, he sent him a plane ticket.
I bet it's first class.
Yeah, well, yeah, I would imagine so.
Up to what budget?
I don't know. But, you know, probably not more than $20, $30 million. But he said, I really want him to come. I did everything. I talked to his sister. I sent him a plane ticket. I guess he sent this plane ticket through his neighbor, who is a well-known architect. And he said, I would pay anything for him to come shoot here. But I guess, you know, Woody Allen has done right by Paris and Rome and Barcelona of late, so.
Well, he's talking about production costs. So he's not talking about the cost of paying the actors or Woody, I believe. I believe production costs would be just the actual filming, right?
Yeah. Well, no, when production costs include paying the actor during the time.
So he's saying the total budget?
Yeah.
Is that a good idea for Rio de Janeiro to spend, say, $15 million to have a Woody Allen movie shoot in their city? I mean, they will get some money back.
Well, given the fact that they are about to have the World Cup and the Olympics,
I don't think they need the attention.
Right. I would say they don't really need to market any more than they already will be doing over the next 4 years. So
now, does Ben Affleck need any attention? Because he got a lot of it because he's been cast as Batman in the sequel to Man of Steel. That, of course, was a successful relaunch of a franchise, though Cavill, the star, is not exactly a big box office name yet. And so they announced that Batman will be in the next Superman movie, and he will be played by Ben Affleck. Now, what does that mean, and why did it happen? This is the story of two stories. Hollywood Reporter did two stories. One, I thought, was an interesting, smart, industry-focused story about why Ben Affleck is being cast as Batman. The other one was a silly one about tweets.
Right. And we could go on and on about the silly one about tweets, but instead, why Ben Affleck as Batman. Certainly, he's got a lot of buzz going on around him. You know, you don't have to market a film with him in it. Well,
not as an actor. He doesn't have
a lot of buzz
as an actor.
He has. He's got the George Clooney thing going on. He's got a lot of.
What? He doesn't have the George Clooney thing going on.
No, where he.
He's not in the same.
It didn't let me finish.
All right, he did win the Oscar for Best Picture, but still,
yes,
I don't know. Calling Ben Affleck George Clooney is a movie star, whereas Ben Affleck is. Made a second career for himself as a director of smaller films, as opposed to Clooney, who can star in anything he wants and is a big, sexy movie star.
As opposed to, say, Clint Eastwood, he did the same thing. He went from in front of the camera to behind the camera. But
again, Ben Affleck isn't Clint Eastwood either.
Right.
He's having a much better career as a director than he ever did as an actor. That's the point.
Well, I'm sure that there are people who would disagree with you and add up the box office that his films have made and say that he had a fairly successful career as an actor.
Right. Well, the fascinating thing is he first broke out as a writer, of course, creating the role that he and Matt Damon did in Good Will Hunting, and they won the Oscar for that. Now he's won an Oscar for his film. His film won Best Picture. He didn't win the Oscar because, I don't know, was he a producer on the film?
Yes, he won the Oscar, actually.
Well, because I was just trying to remember. I knew he didn't win as director. But what I thought was fascinating was one big reason why Ben Affleck...
He wasn't even nominated as director. But anyway, go ahead.
That's right. Why was he cast as Batman? One fascinating reason, because Warner Brothers fired Jeff Robinoff.
Really? Because I know that, you know, Ben Affleck and George Clooney, by the way, they have a really good relationship at Warner Brothers. And Jeff Robinoff was the head of Warner Brothers for so long that you'd think
they had a great relationship with Jeff Robinoff. And when he was kicked out, they wanted to send a message to talent that we love you, we respect you, we're still going to be a great place for you. And the argument was that giving Ben Affleck this role, which of course they wouldn't do unless they thought it was good for the film, but they also thought it sent a very good message that Ben Affleck's important to us. He's a key player for us. He just won the Best Picture. We want him in this big franchise. You know, we're still friendly, you know, talent-loving people here at Warner Brothers. And I think to sort of placate Affleck and all the people who are upset that Robinoff is gone, that this was one big move to say, hey, look, we're, you know, we respect and admire you people, and we're in the business of Ben Affleck.
Okay.
No, does that make sense?
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Although
I was sort of,
I think that there are other ways you could have done that, but keeping Ben Affleck and George Clooney happy are probably a good, and this in, you know, takes care of the former, not the latter, not a bad move.
And of course, the movie needs big stars. The first Superman movie had Kevin Costner and Russell Crowe in big supporting roles, though they both died. Russell Crowe could come back as a hologram, just like he did in this movie, but Kevin Costner won't be back as his dad. So you do need some stars to prop up the film. So it's a kind of a nice win for Affleck. He played Daredevil, and that was a huge flop, an embarrassing movie. They did offer him. They said, do you want to do a reboot of Daredevil and direct and star in it again? And he said no. They also offered him to direct the Superman movie, apparently, at one point. He said no to that because he was afraid of getting back into cape crusading superhero mode. But he did see this as a positive because he's not the star of the film. He's not carrying the film. If it works, he gets credit. If it doesn't work, he won't get the blame. So it's a very safe step into blockbuster territory again for Affleck, who's been a long time between hits as a star in front of the camera.
Yeah.
Finally, one of the best things about it is his ascent. He is really rising. He has a lot of good product coming out, a lot of good movies in the works, a lot of big, high-profile films. He just won the Best Picture for Argo, which he has starred in. He also snagged the lead role in Gone Girl, which is the David Fincher film based on the best-selling novel. As a hugely touted, you know, movie, every actor wanted to have that role of the husband whose wife disappears and he's accused of a murder. I read the book. It's going to be a fun movie. It's a great part. Anybody would want that. And Ben Affleck got it. So that's a big role. Then he shoots Man of Steel 2. And then he writes and directs and stars in the period crime drama Live by Night, which is based on a novel by Dennis Lehane, who's an author of his first breakthrough film that he made, Gone Baby Gone. So this is a big period for Ben Affleck. He has had sort of a low point as far as an actor is concerned, but he's on fire as a director, and now he's got two big plum roles coming up, and then a third film that he's going to write, direct, and star in. So Ben Affleck has been mocked for a number of years. I sort of teased him now when you compared him to George Clooney. You know, they always talk about Geely or Geely or however you say that movie, and Daredevil. Well, he's obviously coming off the highest high that you can, winning Best Picture. And he's got a lot of big roles coming out. So he's going to be in a great period 2-3 years from now. Maybe Matt Damon will look like the guy sort of slacking off.
What, with Elysium?
Yeah, but just in general. Like, come on, where's your directorial debut? Where's your second Oscar? Come on, baby. Ben Affleck's lapping you.
Well, I think
I love Matt Damon. I think he's a terrific actor.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's done quite well for himself.
Yes, I know. But he's always looked like he was lapping Ben Affleck. Now Ben Affleck is really, you know, coming into his own.
Well, you mentioned that there was another story on at least The Hollywood Reporter. And frankly, I think
a lot of places covered it.
Yeah, that once this was announced. And by the way, I did find out on Facebook. But you know how I found out? I found out because Alex Billington was saying that he was out of his office and out to dinner when the news broke. And he couldn't race back home and to write a story for First Showing, his website. Well, you know, I loved the tweet that Richard Rushfield, entertainment journalist, had. He said, to every industry fanboy site that didn't break the Affleck Batman news, aren't you ashamed of yourselves? What do we pay you for? as an inside baseball kind of tweet. I thought that was kind of like a little ding.
But that's not what the story wasn't just a round of tweets. They were making a big deal over the fact that they announced Ben Affleck as Batman. And then they said, in the first hour, 70% of the tweets were negative.
Yes.
As if anybody cares the fact that he's, Ben Affleck, what a dumb idea. He sucks. You know,
well, they were trying to drudge up something, I suppose.
Well, drudge would be the right word.
Well, it was a bit of a surprise, don't you think?
That Ben Affleck was cast? Sure, but I don't care that people in the first hour, 70% of the people tweeted that it was a bad idea. I just don't care.
But remember
that's a waste
when Michael,
of my time.
Remember when Michael Keaton was cast and everybody thought, oh, not a good idea.
Yeah, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. When Daniel Craig was cast as James Bond, people were upset about that. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But, you know, who cares?
I think as an actor trying to play that particular role, and Christopher Nolan is a part of the Superman franchise. He does produce them. And he did come up with the story along with, I think, his brother. You know, that said, Christian Bale did such a good job in that role.
I didn't think so. I love Christian Bale, but I don't think he was great. I couldn't understand his dialogue half the time. I'm not happy with any of those films. I know they're, you know, highly lauded, commercially successful, but I don't think he put a stamp on Batman that nobody can ever play Batman again.
But, you know, so soon afterwards?
They don't even wait a week now between sequels and reboots. You know, they're barely done. They barely finished Spider-Man. They're retelling the same story all over again. I mean, I wish they would wait, take more time, but, you know, they don't do it. Now they want, of course, they want the Justice League. They got to have a Batman. Christian Bale won't do it, so they got to get a new Batman so they can have the Justice League movie and compete with the Avengers. So we can have Batman and Aquaman and Wonder Woman and Superman all in the same movie. That's what they want. Now Ben Affleck has signed up. He signed up for sequels in the Superman and probably, I assume, for the Justice League movie.
Yeah, good point. Well, you know, you say there's a number of sequels. There's so many sequels going on. They don't even wait a week. I think they do wait a week, maybe even a month before they decide to reboot a franchise and, you know, redo all the films they just made. But, you know, talk about something that we might have a glut of besides sequels, I think, is streaming music services.
That's a rough transition, but keep going.
Well, okay.
We've been talking for a long time about Apple launching their competitor to Pandora. And now it's finally going to happen. Do we have a firm release date or is it just September?
Well, September sometime. They have this big announcement on September 10th. That is Apple.
I thought that was the next iPad.
No, it's the next iPhone, everybody believes.
iPhone, September 10th.
And, you know, so I guess iTunes radio will be announced then. But what's really the big news here, in my opinion, is that they're doing it with a lot of big advertisers who have bought 12-month campaigns for tens of millions of dollars. That's a big commitment.
Well, they have a massive base with their iTunes. Everybody, a lot of people use iTunes, and they know they're going to have a big audience out the gate, and these people are signing up, realizing they're going to be able to reach a wide number of people if they get on board with iTunes Radio. So they said, you got to commit. And so McDonald's, Nissan, Pepsi, Procter & Gamble have all signed on with a big, long-term, one-year commitment.
Exclusive. Nobody else can advertise. I think in January of 2014, other advertisers can come on.
Okay.
So I guess the first quarter will be exclusive.
Why would that surprise you? If Apple's doing something new and you can advertise on it, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Right. So what is iTunes Radio? Will it be on your phone? You press a button. It's an app.
Yes.
It's just like Pandora, which means what?
It's just like Pandora.
Which means what?
Which means that the music will stream. And I don't think you get to choose what will stream. So you can like...
type of music?
Yes. You could say, I want jazz and it'll just stream jazz music. Or I want Miles Davis and it'll stream music that's like Miles Davis or Miles Davis music. But then every hour there will be, I guess every 15 minutes, there will be one video ad or
one audio ad. And every half hour, there's a video ad, but you can pay to have it all be ad free if you want. So you can pay X number of dollars a month. We don't know how much. And then you can get rid of the ads.
Well, no, if you pay, I think it's $25 a year, you will get iTunes Match, and iTunes Match customers will not have any ads.
And what's iTunes Match?
iTunes Match, as we've discussed here on the show before, is where you can basically upload all of your music to the cloud.
And but I can't because I have too much.
You can't because you have too much. And Bob Boylan, who was on the show discussing iTunes Match over at NPR, he can't because he's got millions of songs, much like you. And his big problem is, of course, your big problem. 200,000 songs is the limit, which most people don't have. So,
and they don't let you choose which 200,000. You know, I could choose a library of 200,000 songs I might want full access to.
Right.
You know, like my classic 200 albums that I would carry with me everywhere. but they don't let you do that as far as I know.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. They don't allow you to.
Because I tried to do it once and it didn't work out. But anyway, for most people, if you're willing to pay for iTunes Match and have your music in the cloud so you can access this anywhere, you get iTunes Radio for free with no ads.
Yes. Are you going to use this at all? You're probably not going to use this at all, are you?
No, not at all.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing that I will try out for like a day and then never use again, I think. You know, We Are Hunted was a great website and kind of was an aggregator of all the buzz about certain music and bands. And you could listen to the buzzed about music and artists. And then they were purchased by Twitter and they started Twitter Music, which I used for about a week and then I've never touched again.
If I could have all my music accessible anywhere via streaming, I would happily do it. I wouldn't want to pay a lot for it or much of anything, but I wish I could access my music and not have to choose what to carry on the road, because I have a big hard drive that stays here in New York. So when I went down to Alabama for 3 weeks, I didn't have almost any of my music, just what I had on my phone. So, you know, I wish I could do that and stream it anywhere. Though, of course, then you have to be streaming. You know, you can't be on a plane. You can't be here. You can't be there. But no, I would do that. But I think when it's just this sort of generic radio thing, that just doesn't appeal to me. What I really want is curation. I want someone to tell me, here's music I think you like, or somebody whose taste I trust. Like you go to World Cafe. I trust them that if I listen to World Cafe, part of, I think it's NPR. I'm not sure if it's them or one of the other public radio type networks. But when you listen to them, you know, you can hear a couple good songs every hour that you listen to that show. You know, they're going to introduce you to somebody that you'll want to learn more about. So I think that curation, which is what I do on Book Filter, you don't just have some random formula. You don't have generic, oh, you like mysteries? Here's more mysteries. You have someone actually there with taste saying, I've looked at this. I think this is worth your time. So that's what I'm looking
then
for.
Then I have just the site for you. I have just what you need. You know Beats Audio? They have these big headphones that a lot of people wear.
You
just
mean Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine?
Yes. Producer Jimmy Iovine and hip-hop star Dr. Dre. They made these headphones. They're so beautiful. People wear them sometimes just as status symbols. They don't even have them plugged into anything. Well, now they have their own music service, streaming music service. Originally, it was called Project Daisy. Now it's called Beats Music. Surprise, surprise.
And how's it different from all the others?
Well, they are paying freelancers to create playlists.
It's mostly celebrities. It's mostly about musicians and artists and big name people. That's the big thing.
Right.
They're not thinking you're going to be excited that Michael Giltz created a playlist.
You never
know.
They
think you're excited that Dave Matthews creates a playlist. That's where they think the money is.
Yes.
Matthews says, so here's, is it a playlist of like 20 songs or 20 artists, or do they all have to add new playlists every week? What's it going to be?
Well, most of them, by the way, are not, you know, as you said, Dave Matthews. They're freelancers who usually music writers or people who know a lot about music.
Right. You got a writer for Rolling Stone or a person there. They've probably got an online following anyway. But I also think they do believe the stars are really going to attract people.
Oh, absolutely.
If Beck is willing to do a playlist for Beats, a lot of people will listen to it.
That's right. And they say, look, try and keep it around 75 minutes.
Who are you talking to?
You're
describing what Beats says. They're not saying this to the artists. This is what they say to freelancers.
No. Artists get free reign.
I was making a point that Beats Music is really focused on the celebrities. That's where they think people care. But they've also spent a couple bucks to make some poor schlubs like me compile playlists.
Right.
You know, generic nobodies that nobody cares about. And they say, all right, here, create a playlist for this genre or this whatever or this year. And this is the info that they give to those poor little freelancers who don't have a job, don't have any health benefits, getting $2 an hour, probably a flat rate to create a playlist. What do they tell them?
They say, you know, no more than 75 minutes. Avoid overly clever transitions or organizing principles that will be lost on the average listener unless the playlist itself is geared toward connoisseurs. They say talking down to listeners is not desired, so avoid elitism. Playlists should provide the best listening experience within a specific context, as opposed
What do you mean talking down? Isn't it just a list of songs, or do they actually provide commentary?
I have no idea. I have no idea why they. I mean, I thought that these little bullet points were kind of funny.
I don't know if they're funny. They're just sort of vague.
Yeah.
Avoid elitism. Create a really good listening experience. Well, okay.
So if I have classical music in my playlist, does that mean I'm elitist?
No, it doesn't.
I'm just, you know.
So I wonder what music they have access to. Just as iTunes Radio, we believe, has access to all the major labels, does Beats Music have access to what?
I have no idea, but I'm sure when
Are they pulling music from?
I have no idea. I'm sure when they launch later this fall, we will certainly hear about it and they'll be bragging that they have 20 million tracks just like Spotify does.
All right. Well, I think that's I think there's a book. I mean, we don't have a release date for Beats Music, do
no,
we?
No.
But given their track record with their headphones, obviously you don't want to mess with Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. They've had a lot of success with headphones, and they hopefully think they've cracked the nut to compete with Pandora and Spotify and what will be iTunes Radio. So I think it's probably a big deal, especially the fact that we have a release date, or at least a release month for iTunes Radio. That's finally going to happen.
Wait.
So I think that's a big deal.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, did you just say big deal? Because if so, then I can move us right along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. I love this story. Sports programming, of course, is the best way to gain a quick audience on TV. It may also be the best way to gain an audience online. DirecTV has a Sunday ticket package with the NFL that expires in 2014. You know, you can watch all the out-of-market games. So the football people, since that deal expires, they're meeting with all sorts of potential buyers, including Google. Google, of course, owns YouTube, which already airs all sorts of programming and is one of the most widely viewed websites in the world, albeit for 3 minutes at a time. Will the NFL come to YouTube? Will football players hold cute little kittens in their laps while sitting on the sidelines? Because everyone loves cat videos. And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
This is a big whoop.
Really?
Well, they just met with somebody. You know, it's not even like preliminary meetings to talk about a deal. It's like, yeah, they just met with them.
They had lunch.
Yeah.
They went to lunch.
Way in advance. The thing doesn't happen for over a year. It's just all, you know.
So what you're saying is,
we're talking about 2015. They're not, Google hasn't said, oh my God, we're really into this. We're really going to make a serious bid. It's just all malarkey. However, I would like to see Tom Brady with a kitten in his lap. That would be nice.
Okay. Well, I guess it would be a big deal if all of a sudden.
Well, we're talking about a certain package. All the important NFL deals are on major networks and ESPN.
Right.
So that's why they're willing to take this sort of secondary package, which means you're at home, you want to watch an out-of-market team that's not being shown on CBS or ESPN, or Sunday Night Football on NBC, then you can pay for this extra thing and watch it on YouTube. That's,
right.
That's why it's not a big deal.
Right. So when they do, you know, when Google does pay
$1 billion,
if they make
the deal, then it's a deal.
Right. It's $1 billion. You know what Google calls that? Last week.
Yeah.
Now, the darling of the Cannes Film Festival drama, Blue is the Warmest Color, a great movie that I loved, has been given the box office kiss of death rating, NC-17. Its studio, IFC, has already declared, or I should say its distributor, since it's not necessarily a studio, IFC has already declared its intention to release the film in its present cut and not try to re-edit the flick to get a more commercial R rating. Of course, the film includes numerous scenes of lovemaking between two women. If the filmmakers really wanted to get an R rating, they should have simply had the two women shoot at each other. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. We'll be able to see the film the way it was meant to be seen. It wasn't probably going to be a massive commercial success anyway. It's an art house film. And so I don't think it matters one way or the other.
Crime novelist Elmore Leonard died at 87 during our break. His passing was greeted with an extraordinary wave of praise for Leonard as a master of prose, ranking with the best in his genre and among the best ever. As one listener, Jesse Spencer Smith, noted in an email to us, it was an almost perfect send-off for the author of Get Shorty, 310 to Yuma, Glitz, and many
more. My big story, Glitz.
Glitz, yes. That's when you misspell your name, Glitz.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, of course, he wrote many more stories than that. And Jesse Spencer Smith wrote, if only Leonard could have died under mysterious circumstances with multiple suspects. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I was kind of surprised about the amount of attention and praise he received. I didn't realize how widely revered he was beyond the crime genre. I mean, everybody sort of said, no, he's a great writer, period. And that was kind of cool. And I really had a great moment of serendipity because I was in Birmingham, Alabama. I went to a couple of used bookstores to kill some time some days. And for, I don't know why, I guess it's because they have a Western section. You know, bookstores in New York don't have a section for Westerns, but they do in the South. And I went to the section of Westerns in the paperback section, and I thought, oh, it's an Elmore Leonard novel, a couple Westerns that he'd written. I didn't even know he wrote Westerns. I knew that. He wrote 310 to Yuma, the short story. But there you go. I'm looking at these Westerns. I grab one of them sort of offhandedly called Valdez is Coming. So then 2 days later, he dies. And I think, oh, well,
it's fated. Your fault is what you're saying.
It's not my fault. I'm saying I'm fated to read this book. This is the right time to do it. I used to feel guilty when someone died. I would go see their movie or read their book or listen to their music. And I felt a little ghoulish. But then I realized, no, there's no better way to celebrate someone's life than to sample some of the work that they created, especially, you know, their masterpieces. And so I had this book. I read it and I was on a plane. I finished the book. I went, wow, that was a really good book. I pick up USA Today and there's George Pelicanos, a great crime writer, who's saying, here are my five favorite Elmer Leonard books, you know, a tribute to Elmer Leonard. Number one, Valdez is Coming. So wow. Boy, did I pick right. So nice 1970 Western. It was turned into a movie starring Burt Lancaster, but it needs to be remade now.
Okay, because we've waited more than a week and more than a month, so we can remake the movie.
We've waited 43 years, so I think the time is now.
Okay. Just checking. Well, and that's why people should check out bookfilter.com, because, of course, you curate books there.
That's right.
Now, if you listen to Showbiz Sandbox regularly?
Often.
Often. I'm going
to
say often.
If you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, period.
Period. Well, then certainly you know that 2013 is the last hurrah for film. We kind of talked about it a little bit earlier in the show. Not movies, but film as in 35 millimeter, of course, the actual celluloid, the film strip. Come 2014, probably no wide releases in North America will be available in anything other than the digital format. The major chains have already made the switch. You probably haven't watched a movie on celluloid in ages at a multiplex.
Unless you're Sperling and saw Blue Jasmine.
But I did see it at a kind of an indie.
There you go.
Yeah. But, you know, some smaller houses, when it was small, only two theaters, you know, they're struggling to make the switch. Those really left out in the cold, drive-ins, they make very little money, work seasonally, and the cost of buying digital projectors for these mom-and-pop operations is simply prohibitive. There are only about 360 drive-ins left in the United States. 150 of them have gone digital, but that leaves about two-thirds of all drive-ins with just a few months left to come up with about, you know, roughly figure $100,000 to buy a projector for each screen. For years, drive-ins didn't have any customers. Now they may not have any movies either. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for people who love drive-ins. I've gone to drive-ins in the last few years. I love them. It's a lot of fun. And heck, you know, two-thirds of them might be wiped out in one fell swoop. Unless they're just going to keep showing old movies, you know, get prints from archival places. What choice will they have? You know, they can't afford to buy a new projector. They can't show new movies. What are they going to do?
Yeah, I mean,
and it's kind of a passing of an era. At least some of them have been able to make the switch. I'm surprised it's that many, frankly.
Yes, I would agree with you, because they really are seasonal in most of the country. And, you know, I've heard some people say, well, look, they knew this was coming if they had just saved for the last 4 years. The reality is they
could don't make any money.
Yeah, they could have saved for 10 years. They still wouldn't have had $100,000 or even $25,000 to make the switch. So
yeah, they're very mom and pop, you know, the families working the place, the kids behind the counter. They're not making much money at all. It's almost a labor of love. It's like running a used bookstore. You know, you do it for the love, not for the money.
Yeah, Honda has a campaign going on right now where you can vote for, you know, they're going to give away, I think, 4 or 5 projectors, and you can vote for your drive-in. And I think for 2 more weeks, if you vote for your drive-in, the ones with the most votes will get projectors.
And do we link to that in our show notes?
We will be, yes.
Okay.
Now, after 2.5 years of literally sold-out performances, the Tony-winning musical Book of Mormon can add one more accolade to its list. The show from the guys behind South Park is now just one of about 100 shows in Broadway history that have logged more than 1,000 performances after opening. With 8 shows a week, a Broadway event racks up about 400 performances a year. So since it opened in March of 2011, the Book of Mormon has just passed the 1,000th show mark. It doesn't show any signs of flagging. Get it? Doesn't show it anyway. But even if it runs twice as long as it already has, it still won't break into the top 30, which is absolutely amazing to me. Only time will tell how high up Mormon will rank, but it's, you know, already made Broadway history. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. We've seen it coming. We knew it would get there. It's still massively sold out. It's well overbooked and charging the highest ticket prices on Broadway. It's kind of a smaller house. So, you know, it's you know, you look at the 25 years of the Phantom of the Opera, which is still running, and that just makes that blow your mind. This show ran for 2.5 years, and it's one of the top 105, 108 films shows of all time that have broken into the 1,000 performance mark. You have to run for 2.5 years. That's a long time on Broadway. So it just shows you how amazing something like Phantom of the Opera truly is.
Well, now you said you have to wait a week or maybe a month or 43 years to remake a movie or reboot a movie, you know, basically do it all over again on film. What about if you're transferring something from film to Broadway? Do you have to wait that long? Because that's exactly what's happening here with Amelie is actually presently in the works.
As a musical?
I guess so, yes. As a musical.
Well, actually, you know, you say Amelie as a musical. That's, of course, the Oscar-winning film about the...
Not Oscar-winning. It did not win the Oscar.
Oh, it didn't win any Oscars? It didn't win anything?
Well, it didn't win Best Foreign Language Film.
Well, that's Oscar-winning.
It didn't win.
It didn't win?
No.
What beat it?
I can't remember, and I remember being very disappointed that it didn't win that year. And I remember thinking, how could... You know, it was 2001, and I remember being just so... I loved this movie. And I was so upset that it didn't win.
It's won. It's the highest grossing French language film in U.S. history. It won the 4 Césars, including Best Film. It won the European Award for the Best Film. It won 2 BAFTA Awards, including Best Screenplay, and was nominated for 5 Academy Awards. It was not, however, did not win any of them. But certainly it was lauded with Oscar nominations. It was a big commercial success. And as soon as you say musical, I go, yeah, I can picture that. Somehow, that whimsical film about romance, I can see it as a musical. I can hear it singing. So it makes a lot of sense to me. Whereas Big Fish, which is coming onto Broadway this next spring, that to me doesn't say musical, though I'm always hopeful. And I love the star, Bobby Steggert. But Amelie, that makes to me, I'm like, yeah, I can totally hear that and see that. It makes absolute sense that you would turn that into a musical.
Now, I would say, just for those who are wondering, this is a tough year. 2001 was when it was released. So 2002 was the year that it was nominated and up for an award. It was up against Lagan, Once Upon a Time in India. Great movie. It was also up against No Man's Land from Bosnia, which was also...
That won, yes.
And the director, I think, has made one additional movie, Denis Tenevich. But No Man's Land was a good movie, but I do remember thinking, oh, I really would have loved to have seen Amelie win.
Well, you know, probably some people voted for Best Picture, so they didn't vote for Best Foreign Film, and the other way around. So, you know, it sort of split its vote that way. What were the other two movies? Anything we'd heard of?
Elling and I can't remember the other one.
It had an anti-war message, so yeah. It was seen as more noble and serious. I would have voted for Amelie, but that's the Best Foreign Film Oscar for you. But, you know, there you go. It's about a shy waitress. She changes the lives of everyone around her, even though she's sort of lonely herself. It's charming. It's sweet. It's adorable. Who are you going to get to take over that role made famous by Audrey Tautou? There's a great casting coup. I'm sure casting agents are already sharpening their pencils to think, who could play Amelie on Broadway? She has to be able to sing and be charming.
That's true.
But, you know, it makes perfect sense to me. So I'm looking forward to it. I mean, who's involved in the project?
Some guy named Hem. I know that's not a lot to go
on.
No,
that's a band. That's a band.
Oh, okay.
It's probably a member of the band Hem. It's Dan Messay.
Dan Messay. Hem's Dan Messay. Sorry, yes.
Okay, yeah. No, he or they. I don't know whether it was Hem or actually just Dan.
Dan Messay
did. I think they did a score for a public theater, you know, Shakespeare in the Park production, which I remember being pretty good.
Right. And you know, I guess playwright Craig Lucas and lyricist Nathan Tyson are also working on it.
Craig Lucas is doing the book. He's won the Pulitzer Prize. He did Sealed with a Kiss. What's it called?
Kiss of the Spider Woman. I don't know.
No. Craig Lucas, his play. But lyricist Nathan Tyson, I don't know who he is either.
Look at us. It's like we don't even have the internet anymore.
Well, you brought this project up. I don't know nothing about it. Prelude to a Kiss is the Craig Lucas thing. I just remembered that. I didn't look it up.
No, okay. Well,
we've taken a long enough time. Book of Mormon is a big hit. Amelie's being turned into a musical. Moving on.
Sony has PlayStations in tens of millions of homes. They already stream Netflix, Hulu, and, you know, and everything else. Viacom has popular channels like Nickelodeon and MTV, and its owner Sumner Redstone also controls CBS. Now they've struck a tentative deal, Viacom that is, to make Viacom channels available on a standalone basis via Sony PlayStations. That could be the workaround that ends the cable monopoly in so many homes, assuming lots of other TV providers like Time Warner Cable sign on and the service could offer enough top channels to make it worth quitting your cable subscription. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think we meant to say Time Warner, not Time Warner Cable. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't work. Sony wants to offer, you know, TV channels standalone. It only works if you're able to offer a lot of them.
Right.
You got to get almost all of them or nobody's going to switch. You're not going to cut your cable provider if you can't get all the major networks and almost all the channels you want. Otherwise, you won't do it. So Viacom is the first good step. got some good channels like Nickelodeon and MTV. If they get CBS, then that's even saying something more.
Well, if they get CBS, it's more than the Time Warner Cable has.
Right. But until they sign all the major networks and a good chunk of the biggest channels like ESPN, it isn't going to work. So it's you know, it doesn't matter. It's a big whoop unless they actually get a lot of. So it's a big deal once they sign up a lot of channels.
The Astoria Bookshop is opening in Queens, New York, that is. Good news for the book industry? Yes, especially since a sci-fi bookstore and a kids' bookstore opened recently in the area, in Queens. On the other hand, the Astoria Bookshop had volunteers coming in to help paint the store and alphabetize product, and they raised $8,000 in donations to buy more stock. Is this a business or a local charity? I've seen less volunteers at a community garden. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. You know, this is sad. This is what you do to open a bookstore. You have to beg for money so you can buy books to put on the shelf. You got to get volunteers to come in and paint the store and put it's ridiculous.
You know,
it's lovable that they're doing it. God bless them. But it isn't a sign of strength for the industry. It's a sign of weakness.
You know, I saw this list on BuzzFeed, the 27 record stores you have to visit and have to shop at. And I went through the entire list, and, you know, it was one of those photo things where they had pictures of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, wait a second, these are like the 27 record stores that remain in operation. In any case. If Google and the NFL sign a deal, would Google cave to NFL pressure and lower negative links when people search for football and concussion together? Do you think they'd do that? Probably not. That's not so far-fetched a question, though. After working side-by-side with the venerable PBS documentary series Frontline, the sports network ESPN has pulled out of a major documentary they had been cooperating on for more than a year. The work is an explosive look at football players and injuries from concussions, specifically when top NFL officials knew about the dangers and what they did or didn't do about it for years. The New York Times reported that ESPN pulled out after a very tense meeting with the NFL. Both of them deny the claim, but ESPN's official involvement has ended and their logo pulled off promotional material for the film, which debuts in a matter of weeks. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, it's a sad example of caving to pressure. ESPN always has that conflict of interest, but everyone has tons of conflicts of interest. You know, you're on a Fox TV station and you're reviewing a Fox movie. I mean, these conflicts are inevitable, but how do you deal with them? And in this case, ESPN dealt with them very poorly. They've known about this project for a long time. They were there promoting it at the conventions where the TV writers come and all the networks
TCAs,
tout all their up.
Yeah.
Yeah, the TCAs. And that's where this stuff got their first big, you know, exposure, and they showed a trailer. Suddenly they meet with the NFL and ESPN says, oh my gosh, we didn't realize it was going to be so, you know, controversial and that they were going to be so provocative. And those people at Frontline are just out of control with their provocative. It's like, really? Frontline is now, you know, dredging up, you know, tabloidism. And they made it sound like, oh, we had no idea we wouldn't have control over it and how and what the trailer is and how the film is cut. Yes, they had. They knew exactly what their involvement was for over a year. They were working with them side by side, and they caved to pressure from the NFL. It's a very, very bad precedent.
Well, on the flip side, I have heard the film is not very good, that the product itself is not very good.
Who's seen it?
A couple of critics. It was in the LA Times, actually. I'll have to dredge that up and put a link in the show notes.
Well, I mean, Frontline does excellent work, so I'd be surprised if it didn't have some value to it.
I think it's called The United States of Football.
No.
No? Okay. Maybe I'm thinking of another movie.
That is a project, but that's not the same thing. That's a different project.
Okay.
I believe.
Okay. Well, the latest way to tout your hipster credential is to sell some vinyl, apparently. Urban Outfitters has a vinyl section in many of its stores. I like their vinyl jackets, actually. The vinyl is also records.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, now Whole Foods is getting into the act. About 5 California sites are offering vinyl, often with their own actual separate store space, you know, of sorts. It's literally vinyl because CDs are so 2005. The selection is small and obvious. CCR, Bob Marley, Daft Punk, some hip picks by Pitchfork, and so on. It's not a record store so much as a gesture towards music. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? I mean, as it is at Whole Foods, bag of groceries, one bag of groceries costs about $150. So what do you think, Michael? Big deal?
It is completely a big whoop.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
It's not important in any way, shape, or form as far as selling albums or music. First of all, they're only selling vinyl, you know, so it's like you're already limiting your audience. It's not important at all. It's a cute little thing. What's sad is that it's turning, you know, music into like a decorative tchotchke. Ah, I'll buy an old CCR, Creedence Clearwater Revival album on vinyl. Isn't that cute?
Yeah, and I guess they're fresh out of the National Enquirer.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. They're not going in a serious way to try and make music available that might appeal to their customers. And in fact, the article in the LA Weekly sort of mocks Starbucks as, you know, how lame they are. At least Starbucks commissioned new albums and made actual curation choices and said, we think you're going to like this Ray Charles album. We think you're going to like this Madeline Peru album. They broke some artists. From the lineup we have here, it doesn't seem like Whole Foods has any intention to break artists. It's just a cute little designery thing. It's just, it's dumb and it's annoying because I love music and I hate to see it, done so poorly.
Yeah, you know,
there's so few places to buy music. I wish they'd done it right.
You know, it's funny. I agree with you on Starbucks. Hear Music was their label, and they did a great job. They just didn't do a great job of marketing. They knew how to market coffee. They did not know how to market music.
Well, they broke some acts, but they only would do like 2 or 3 or 4 CDs, and I think it served their purpose. But I wish they'd gone into it more completely because they had done a good job. To clarify, the Frontline film is called League of Denial, the NFL Concussions, and the Battle for Truth. As far as I know, no one has seen it. The film you're talking about is a similar film. It's about a father. It's a documentary about a father whose son was going to go play football, and he looks into this issue, and he decides, you know, it's a diatribe about the same issue, about concussions and little kids and when they should play football. So it's on the same topic, but it's a completely separate documentary. It has nothing to do with the Frontline story.
And that's the film I was referring to.
Right, and that came out in 2012.
Yeah, exactly. It's now going to be shown in movie theaters, I believe. The co-host of the Miss Universe pageant for the past 2 years turned down the job this coming November because he was afraid of being arrested in Russia, which is remarkable since they let Edward Snowden go. You know, go figure. Andy Cohen is a Bravo TV personality and openly gay. Russia's new draconian anti-gay laws are sparking international attention and increased pressure on the Olympics about guaranteeing the safety of athletes and the awkward position of hosting an event in a country that will make some of its participants feel unwelcome by, you know, possibly beating them up and throwing them in jail. Well, Cohen stated he couldn't imagine traveling to Russia under current laws since he would inevitably be open to arrest, not to mention the government's clear indifference to brutal attacks on gay people. The event takes place November 9th in Moscow, apparently without Andy Cohen, and there was no comment from Bravo. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but it's another piece of the puzzle in what's going on with the Olympics. Are you even aware of what's going on with the Olympics and the pressure that's building on sponsors and the Olympics and the different countries that are acting up about what Russia's doing?
Well, I don't know the nitty-gritty of it all, but I know it's occurring.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of unusual. It's just, you know, it's people always compare it to the Olympics that were held in Berlin in 1936, I think it was, right before World War II.
1935, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that 35 couldn't be 35, could it?
39, 30. I'll look it up while you keep going.
Yeah, it was Jesse Owens at the Olympics. And they compare it to that where you say, oh, you know.
You were right, 1936.
Right. And said, but the difference is that you weren't going to arrest Jesse Owens or his wife just because he was there with his wife and he's black. Well, they're literally saying they will arrest anybody who does anything that they decide is remotely gay. And in fact, they now claim it's a terrorist act if you even show the slightest support. So if NBC does a story and say, oh, this athlete is gay, they could be arrested. If they do a story on the fact that Russia has this boycott, they could be arrested, thrown out of the country, thrown into jail. This is what's happening. So they're literally telling athletes they're unwelcome. If an athlete's spouse, you know, comes to the Olympics, that could be because they can't walk down the street and hold hands. If an athlete goes into the hospital, which happens a lot, you're at a big athletic event, their spouse can't go to the hospital and say, I'm her husband, her wife. I want to see her, because they'll arrest you because now you're saying you're a lesbian. I mean, you know, the Olympics does not like to get involved in politics at all. They avoid it. They've been in lots of countries that do lots of terrible things. They went to China. China's terrible to Tibet. But they don't want to deal with politics. They just want to host the Olympics and have it held and say it's a good force for the world. But in this case, it's interfering with the actual games. And there's a slight possibility in the next few weeks that it's unlikely, but that they could move the Olympics back to where it was held last time. Or
wait, where was it held? It was held...
Well, there's a couple different locations where they could go that people have talked about where they already have the facilities in place to host the Olympics. You know, it has to be the same seasonal event Olympics. That's a possibility, though a very unlikely one. But it is going to become a huge, huge publicity nightmare for the Olympics and for Russia. The Olympics have bungled it every step of the way. And I'm talking about the International Olympic Committee. The U.S. Olympic
Wait, the International Olympic Committee bungling something? I'm shocked,
well,
I tell you.
Well, but there's different countries. The U.S. Olympic people have been pretty good. Canada's been great. A lot of other countries have been good and denouncing Russia and saying this is unacceptable. You can't tell. You know, they asked Russia, Can you guarantee our athletes will be safe? It took Russia 3 weeks to respond. And
they
say,
were on vacation.
And you know, yeah, but you know what they said? They said, no. You have to follow our laws. If you break our laws, we will arrest you, just like you do in every other country. But their laws have now been written to the point where anything you do can be construed as a terrorist act. They're not just saying you're breaking them, but you're a terrorist, and they'll throw you into jail.
They may even start monitoring all of the incoming communications to their country. Oh, wait, never mind.
Right. So this is a big news story that will grow and grow in the months to come as we get closer to the Olympics in 2014.
Like a fungus, it'll grow.
If you haven't been paying attention, this guy, you know, saying, I'm not going to hold the Miss Universe. Now FIFA is talking about soccer. They're saying maybe Russia shouldn't be in the soccer league. Russia shouldn't be hosting any soccer events. They're talking to Russia and saying, what are you doing? What, you know, we can't have our players coming there and being threatened or being arrested. So this is going to be a growing issue in the months to come.
Well, you know, Putin, who now is the prime minister of Russia, and we shouldn't get into politics
again.
Here. Yes, again.
Again, he's more the czar of Russia, but
yeah.
Anyway.
He got his career start. He started his career in the KGB during the Cold War, and that's when the KGB was really important, when, you know, you actually needed to spy on people. So he's actually kind of reverting the country back to that time period, I think.
Well, more like the time of the czars, and they want someone to hate, and Russia used to use the Jews, and they can't use the Jews anymore so easily. So now, because Putin personally is very friendly to the Jews, as a kid, he was saved from a schoolyard beating by another Jewish student. And so he's always had a fondness and friendship with Jewish people. So he's not willing to use Jews as scapegoats. So he's turned to gay people quite plainly and directly to say, let's blame all our ills on them. Because he's, you know, when you're a dictator and you want to focus the ire of your people, you don't want them to be mad at you. You want them to focus on some other enemy. So he uses the West and he uses gay people. And that's what he's doing.
Well, let's move on to something maybe a little lighter. The number one show on TV last week was the new season premiere of Duck Dynasty. Virtually no listings of the top 10 or top 20 shows actually reflected this. There's that word again, reflected. And that's because TV ratings are still stuck in the dark ages, with major networks like CBS, ABC, NBC, and Fox given preferential treatment over cable channels like History and HBO and AMC. And as for the viewers who watch on DVR a few days later or on demand or via a website, yeah, what about them? No one even bothers to try and include them. So The Walking Dead may be the biggest hit of the fall, and Duck Dynasty may be the biggest hit of the summer, and football on Sunday afternoons may draw more viewers than almost anything in prime time, but you wouldn't know it by looking at the TV ratings. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. We've talked about it before. It drives me nuts. It's the only industry I know where they try and hide the fact of what the most popular shows are. They've got popular product and they won't tell people about it. And they're doing themselves a huge disservice. And they really need to catch up and start to count the actual viewers and share with people what are the top shows of the week. I don't care if it's the Today Show. I don't care if it's an interview with Oprah on her own network, which isn't the case for Lindsay Lohan because nobody watched that thing. I don't care what it is, where, or when. I want to know what the top shows of the week are, and they're really hurting themselves. It was a great boon to the music industry when they switched to actual sales, when their charts reflected actual sales. It's a good switch for the book industry when they switched to actual sales. People could see what's really popular, and they need to do that with TV, and they need to do it now.
Wow. Are you running for office?
Maybe mayor.
Well, struggling filmmaker Spike Lee has raised $1.25 million for a new film project he wants to tackle about people addicted to the blood. No, it's not a remake of Blackula. Detractors are pointing to famous talent like Lee and the people behind Veronica Mars and asking why they are using Kickstarter. Lee counters that he's actually introducing a lot of people to this form of crowdsourcing, and hey, he's always fought to get his movies made, so don't start giving him any grief now. Oh, my former professor, Spike Lee. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's good that he got, you know, his movie made, and I'm empathetic with Spike Lee. You know, he's never found it easy to get his movies bankrolled and made. So he's always scrabbled and he's always done what he could to get it happen. So if he can use Kickstarter, more power to him. But I do think I've just been deluged with the next month or two. Kickstarter and all these other things. They're like, oh, Indiegogo and all these things. We're trying to raise money for our album, our movie, our animated series, our documentary. It's like it's been every day I get something talking about this, that, and the other thing. We're recording our cast album. We want to do this. It's like, this has got to end. This is not going to, the heyday of getting people to pay for you to do your stuff, I think, is fairly over.
Yeah, I think, you know, like everything, it'll run its course.
Yeah, well, not everything. Movies are made and released in theaters. That hasn't run its course. But the idea that you can go to your fans and get them to fundraise your stuff for big projects, I think that's over. I think if you actually give them actual valuable product, like you say, give me $15 now and you'll get the CD when the album comes out, I think that can still work.
Yeah, but so basically pre-selling.
The just the pleasure of, you know, giving $50 so they can make a movie, I think that's going to end pretty quick.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I participated in a Kickstarter campaign, and this was apparently in 2012, I think it was, or 2011, for the best music writing of 2012. They were going to kind of publish this book that had been published for years, and they weren't going to publish it anymore. And the editor said, hey, I'm going to put this project together myself. I contributed, I think, $20, $30 to it, and then I kind of forgot about it. And last week, there were all these stories saying, look, it's been 18 months. Where's this book? And so the editor who ran the campaign said, look, I know I messed up. It was a way bigger task than I thought. I can edit, okay, but I can't, you know, operate.
Create a copy for all the different platforms and all that stuff.
Yeah, she said, this is a huge task. And she said, you know what? I'm going to repay all of my backers. I'm going to repay. It's going to take me 3 years, but I'm going to pay everybody back. Now I'm.
Why would it take her 3 years? Where was the money?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my question is, I'm somewhat conflicted. Should I take the money or should I say, hey, you know what? Just forget about it. It was $20. Good luck with your life.
I think you should take the money. Okay. I don't think she should have spent the money. Why does she not have the money in an account? If she said I would do this project and failed to do it because she couldn't handle all the technical demands or didn't raise enough money to do it properly and have people.
You know what? You know, I didn't read her full posts, but I'm sure in there it explains. Yeah, I only read the first paragraph.
I certainly wouldn't be terribly empathetic. You know, like, she asked you to help support something. You were just giving her money for free to do it, and she failed. I don't see why you shouldn't get your money back.
Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And that does move us along, however quickly or slowly, whatever you want to say, to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this week, Michael, we can really say that these stories really do affect us, especially you and I, who are Time Warner Cable customers. By the way, I should have, in our top 10, said that we spent 2 weeks correcting every major media outlet that it's not Time Warner, it's Time Warner Cable.
Oh, do a lot of other people make that mistake
too? It was in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, every single outlet. I thought, wow, they really they're not making a distinction.
Well, it's a different company, so thank goodness to our readers for keeping us honest. Now we look smarter than everybody else.
That's right.
So tell us about this story.
I was going to ask you about this story. Basically, this is a story that a la carte and a la carte pricing and going away from it is a bad idea.
It was from Adweek, right? It was a column in Adweek.
That's right. It's the worst idea ever. They say that are they saying that bundling is socialism?
Well, yeah, I mean, I sort of agree with the gist of the article. I think people always say, oh, I wish I could pay for individual channels, but you'd end up really being frustrated and annoyed because there'd always be a new channel that you wanted to see a show and you wouldn't have it and you'd have to call up and you'd have to order it and you have to pay for it. I think bundling is basically a fairly good deal in philosophy in general. I think my cable bill is too high, but I think bundling works pretty well. But even though I agree with him that bundling is probably better than a la carte pricing for most people, I disagree with some of the points he made. And like you say, the first one he made was he said, bundling is like socialism. And right. He says, you know, we all chip in to get a huge number of channels and just watch what we want. And I'm like, yeah, that's not socialism. That's capitalism.
Right.
Socialism is not tossing Sci-Fi and ESPNU and the House and Garden Channel onto your cable package. Socialism is when everyone says, hey, public television is important and we should all fund PBS. That's socialism. So bundling is not socialism, it's capitalism.
And he's saying that ESPN makes $6 per subscriber, which is more than I've ever heard. I've heard like $3 or $4, but not $6. You can see
I saw the Times just reporting $5 per subscriber.
Wow, it's all over
the
place.
I did just see $5 per subscriber. So I was wondering about that $6. But let's say it's $4 per subscriber. That means they make $400 million a month from households. So if you're paying your cable bill, $4 of that goes right to ESPN, and there are about 100 million households plugged into cable, right?
Right.
So that means they would get $400 million a month from their subscribers.
Well, plus their advertising.
Right, right. We're not there yet. Right. So they say, so this person says if they were a la carte, then they to get make that same amount of money, they'd have to have 20 million sports fanatics who'd pay like $20 a month to get ESPN. Right? So then they would keep their $400 million a month, to which I say, wait, advertising. They don't just make money off the subscription. They also make money off ads. And if they're and if they do go a la carte and they charge that much money, a lot of people won't do it. So instead of 100 million households, they would have just 20 million households because I wouldn't pay it. I wouldn't pay $20 a month for ESPN. And guess what that means? They'd have a much smaller audience for their shows and they make a lot less money on advertising. So just because they make $6 an hour or $5 per subscriber now or per household, don't think they could get that same amount of money if they were a la carte because they want a big audience. It's to their advantage to be on a big channel. That's why they don't want to be on tiers. That's why they want to be on that second or third tier. They want to be on basic cable. So anyone who buys cable gets ESPN because that's to their advantage. A big audience with a lot of eyeballs. That's what they depend on to make a lot of their money.
Well, yeah, and a lot of money for Disney, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, he also kind of says, you know, 10 channels in a la carte would cost you about $78 a month.
Right. Well, that sounds crazy. That's like $8 a channel average, right, which sounds really high. And he's arguing with that at the current levels. If you break it down for the really popular channels, that's what you'd end up having to pay. Well, they couldn't charge their current levels because they're a la carte now. They can't get away with the fact that you're not really paying for 500 of the channels, but just the four or five that you really want. So they can't get away with that. They can't charge you that much. So again, his logic doesn't make any sense. It's not $8 per channel. Even ESPN probably only charges $5 or $6 per household. So how he got 10 channels to $78 a month, I don't know.
So what's the big takeaway here? A la carte, bad idea.
Well, here's one more thing. He says viewers would suffer because if we don't pay all this money to the cable companies, which sends all the money to the cable channels like ESPN, how could ESPN pay all those massive rights fees?
That's true.
Right? Like ESPN, how can they afford to pay $1.9 billion annually just for NFL football? How can they pay $700 million a year to Major League Baseball? I'm like, you've got it backwards, buddy. They're paying that much money because they're soaking us for so much money on our end.
That's right.
If we paid half that amount, you know what? We're paying all this money so ESPN can pay all that money to the baseball and to the football. Well, guess what? Maybe those guys can, you know, make $10 million a year rather than $20 million a year. You know, they've got it all backwards. Like, oh, they can't afford these huge right fees if they don't charge us a lot. No. Charge us half the amount and your right fees will be half the amount.
That's right. Right. Yeah, think exactly. About it this way. I always go back to the Dodgers on this on that topic. And as a matter of fact, that's a good little gripe that I have. Okay, so the Dodgers, they were sold in 2002, 2003, somewhere in there to Frank McCourt, this guy from Boston. So Fox News Corp, sold them to this guy.
This guy from Boston, you make it sound like he just wandered it off the street.
No. It's a, you know, he was a
major businessman. Yeah.
And they sold it to him for $400 million, $400 million and change. Okay. First off, the Dodgers had been around for decades. I mean, since the 30s, 40s. Okay. So in 60, 70 years, it took to earn and to make a team worth $400 million, most of which he had to borrow, by the way, but he had to borrow it from the seller, News Corp. Then last year, 10 years later, he sells the Dodgers for $2.7 billion. So you're saying somehow in the 70 previous years, they were only able to make it up to $400 million. But 10 years after that, having won no championship series, it was somehow worth $2.7 billion. How is that? The only reason it was worth that much money is because of the cable deals.
Right, because they would be able to charge so much for their games.
Now,
get such a big flood of money from ESPN and all these other places in Major League Baseball.
Right. Now, baseball is a legalized monopoly. Congress has said, yes, we know it's a monopoly. You can't have two competing sports leagues because it'll just, you know, both will suffer. Okay, fine.
It's an outdated rule.
Now, cable. Okay. They have geographic monopolies. Okay. Broadcasters like CBS, they have, in a way, licensed monopolies, so that the license will expire and they will have to renew it or they won't be a must carry anymore. But so where's all this going? The Dodgers are on two channels here in Los Angeles. They're on Fox Sports West. Okay. So that's their cable carrier.
The original cable company. Yeah.
Yeah. And they are on KCAL, which is Channel 9 here in Los Angeles. Guess who owns KCAL?
Fox.
CBS.
Ah.
So CBS is blacking out Dodgers games. You basically have one licensed monopoly and one geographic monopoly fighting with each other, blocking out the third monopoly. And in the end, the only people who are hurt by this are the Dodger fans, the sports fans, and the Time Warner and the TV customers.
And does that tie into a la carte or anything? Or
it's no,
just it's another just, example of how messed up cable sports coverage is and
pretty
the
much.
Rights.
Yeah. It was just me venting. How did that go for you?
It went good. It went good.
Okay. Just checking.
Maybe someday people can hear me vent for 20 minutes with our fight over Kevin Spacey and all things D. Well, and, someday a special issue. We'll play the half hour that we had between the end of Big Deal, Big Whoop and the beginning of Inside Baseball.
And that was the original the original end of Big Deal, Big Whoop, which involved Kevin Spacey and me realizing.
Cable a la carte is perhaps not a great idea, but his reasons weren't very strong, and it's not coming anytime soon anyway.
Yeah, so I'm glad we mentioned it.
Yes.
Well, now, should we read this listener email, or should we?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
Sure, I'll read it. Michael and Sperling. This is from...
We should probably switch off paragraph by paragraph. This is a
Nick
long...
Nick Raskin of New York, New York. Nick Raskin of New York, New York. Hey, Nick. Be prepared for me to both agree and disagree with you in this email. Okay. Over the last show or two, you mentioned that the New York Times paid $1.1 billion for the Boston Globe in 1993. I agree with the caveat that this purchase was for the New England Media Group and not just the Globe. Oops. claim that in its 20-year ownership, the Times lost nearly all of the Globe's value, as evidenced by its recent sale to Boston Red Sox owner John Henry for a sale price of $70 million. I agree. You stated that the Times' investment in the Globe was a huge financial boondoggle that cost the company $1.1 billion. Here's where I disagree. True, few acquisitions of operating entities are made with the intention that the ongoing business endeavor will eventually lose its entire worth and value. There are exceptions, of course, when acquisitions are made for competitive or other factors related to market issues, though usually, if the purchasing company intends on running the existing business, they would want to increase its value. In the 20 years the Times ran the Boston Globe, it most certainly did lose a great deal of value in both goodwill and actual worth. The Times itself has lost most of its own worth in the last 15 years, going from a market cap of $8.8 billion in 1999 to its current cap of $1.6 billion. Yet the Times also may not have lost as much financially in its investment in the Globe as you proclaim. Keep in mind, they operated it for many years at a profit. Their ownership gave them an advantage with advertisers wishing to purchase more expensive campaigns in two large metropolitan cities. There were also some tax advantages. And as revenues began to decline over the last half decade, the Times reduced operating expenses. Ideally, a revenue-generating entity such as the Globe would have increased its value over time, though that is not always the case when an asset loses value due to depreciation, obsolescence, or changing market conditions. It's unclear how much income the Times earned from the Globe during its ownership and before the losses of the past 5 years, since they don't break out earnings in their financial reporting. What is known is that the $70 million sale price was for cash, and the buyer took on $100 million in legacy pension liability, which I think we mentioned. This actually makes the sale value roughly $170 million, a lot closer to the $250 million Jeff Bezos overpaid for the Washington Post. That kind of fact is difficult to explain, however, and besides, having one of the most recognized and wealthiest newspapers in the country seem to lose so much money from an acquisition is a much juicier story, even if that story overlooks a few of the devilish details. Love the show. Keep up the hard work. Nick Raskin, New York, New York.
Wow. You said that in one breath.
Well, I think he makes good points. I think if we had the... was it 20 years that they had it?
Yeah.
They had 15 years of at least some financial gain and 5 years of punishing losses. And then they actually, you know, they've got virtually nothing of what they paid back out of it at the end. I think if we added it all up, it would still be probably close to $900 million, $1 billion. I mean, I don't know, but newspapers have been losing money for quite a while now. He does make an excellent point about what other properties they might have acquired as far as when they purchased the company. I don't think anything was too significant, or we would have heard about it.
They were all local newspapers, but basically this was the New York Times way of getting out of all these local newspapers that they were in, including
right,
the Boston Globe.
When they purchased the Boston Globe, he's saying there were other pieces of available in that purchase. It wasn't just the Boston Globe.
Right.
Right. So there were other entities involved. And they probably were not making a lot of money over the last years either. I think the general gist that they lost a lot of money is certainly true, but he's right that you have to say, hey, for maybe 10 years they made money. So you got to add that into the mix as far as how much the ultimate financial loss was. Absolutely fair point, and thanks for writing.
Yes, well, that does wrap up our show this week. We urge you to encourage you to write to us, just like Nick Raskin did. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. Our number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Or I should just say, it's Showbiz Sandbox. And our username on Facebook, where you could like us, is Showbiz Sandbox. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher. I found out we're still on the Zune Marketplace, so even though nobody's using Zune anymore, we're still there. Anywhere they give out podcasts for free, that's where you can find our podcast. And we do encourage you to rate and review the show there. I guess what else can we tell people? I guess, you know, links to all the stories that we discussed on today's show, they can be found on our website in the show notes for episode 202. Our website is showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those links for ways to contact us by email, by phone, follow us on Twitter, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. Michael, you want to tell people what it is this week?
It's allthingsd.com.
Oh my goodness. You know what? Unfortunately, nobody will understand what that's all about. And
it's a fine website, but you can also check out bookfilter.com or michaelgiltz.com.
Yes, for some of his journalistic work, michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.